I'll get some beer for you, but we have it on stage.
Wine.
Oh, wine? No, yes. We don't
wine.
Have
wine. Water.
It's still a puritanical.
Yes, we have
some
wine,
water in the last day.
Please, Oscar, do you want to stand?
Well, you
no?
Do
you want to stand?
There's nothing else we can do.
Okay.
Thank you very much for these incredible presentations this afternoon. I think we really covered a hugely broad territory and really, I think, elucidated the, like, as you said, it was perfect to have you, Anna, at the very start, the kind of the political ramifications or the stakes involved in the formation of technical norms and why there's, especially now, a real political fight to be had about it because of its implications. So I think, Victoria, you had some burning questions.
No, not so much
panel.
A burning question. It would be useless to try to reassemble, I think, the entirety of 4 hours. So thank you very much for staying with us, or almost 4 hours. I think we'll just start with one question that Patricia and I have sort of come up with as a way of trying to perhaps kind of insert a certain conversation or a certain language that kind of went missing and quite intentionally went missing in these presentations, and then open up to the audience for questions. So the question is kind of tracing back to 1948. I guess the kind of event that we left out of the picture, or it was alluded by Oscar, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right? And that's kind of, that's an important event in so far as it constructs a really important token, an ethical political token of the abstract human legal subject. And one of the reasons it seems important to kind of revisit that event is not so much to kind of assess the successes or the failures of the Universal Human Rights Project, but to understand how that kind of dream of universality that particular project had within it, how it had sort of fragmented or disintegrated, or in turn how it has evolved in a completely different manner as a result in part of, let's say, a certain economic model or market-driven individuation kind of taking over this sort of more ethical, politically aligned, at least, vision of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and to perhaps think with the sort of image or architecture of the world that emerges in the descriptions of different presenters, you know, particularly, let's say, the stag being, let's say, the most sort of image-ready representation of that order. How do we kind of hold on, or do we need to hold on to a certain universalism that can function at a multiscalar level? So we don't renounce that, right? But how can we still hold on to a certain generality when what is being produced is effectively a certain kind of fragmentation at the level of logistics and logics? Something that, you know, if we were to look at Ben's account, something will keep on becoming more apparent in the years to come. And so is there a sense to come back to this 1948 moment as one of universal generality? And I guess the question is, how do we do it? Is finance one way through which we can still hold on to certain universality? You know, is it going back to certain conceptions of tokens that have been left occluded within the evolutionary basis of the last 50 plus years? So yes, this is a question to everyone, and I guess if it's a huge question,
I mean,
but maybe if somebody could start.
I would wonder if I don't want to break in, but I wonder if it's really so easy. The question why easy is, it's complicated anyways, no? But it feels to me that now it has become a competitive field. And I'm saying that because I remember in 2008, I was in Beijing. We did a video work, me and my partner, Sylvia Ackermann, and we interviewed all kinds of people. One of them was a philosopher, Qingdao Yang, something like that, who was a specialist in human rights. That was what he was doing in philosophy. But that didn't mean, like a European philosopher being a specialist in that he would, you know, kind of philosophize about it. But his job was at the Beijing University is to write human rights, because the Chinese were totally unhappy and have ever been since then with the European way, the Western way of human rights. And we were talking, and he didn't, of course, say exactly how it would work out, but what he said was, it will be a credit system. And I was like, okay. So 5 or 6 years later, I read in a newspaper something about a CSME credit score, and I read through and back. it kind of hits me, because I think that's what he was talking about. That's the Chinese form of human rights, bringing in a scoring system that's electronically, that network distributed, but with a clear state angle, that is implemented in an app that has not just credit scoring, but it has all kinds of other scoring activities, that payment functions, it has maps, etc., like WeChat and with Red Envelope. Integrating this into one kind of app with all kinds of these differentiations, that turns up, and if that happens, and this is really about a human rights objective of the Chinese, then you have a massive, intense, kind of like product of human rights that will be very hard to challenge. Because that's what they're going to sell through all the infrastructures which they're building now in Asia, in Africa, etc. So that was just something that came up.
Yeah, I mean, this one of the things we were looking at in this issue of the Chinese stack. I mean, again, to me, the Sesame's hasn't been developed as we feared in some sort of ways, but it will be more by 2020 is the date that they're sort of looking at this as well. And Tencent and Alibaba are part of the development of this. But again, I see this more of a sort of generalized debt than anything else, that as opposed to a credit score in which there's a sort of debt that's taken on, and then your ability to rush to that. In this sense, the sort of mandatory, the universality, the universal logic of this, that anyone over a certain age is sort of part of this, is that the condition that a social contract is one of social debt that's constantly sort of structured around this as well. And so I guess one of the things I was, just to go back to this sort of question again, back to 1948 is, I mean, there's many kinds of, there isn't a universality. I guess there's different ways in which you might take the universal within this as well. And so part of the question is also how it might be, I think to your point, its relationship and how it can be laminated with or tethered to questions of legal rights. And of course, this is the fraught question. And how it may be, and I think part of the problem, of course, with the presumption that kind of the Kantian notions of a cosmopolitanism, that what sort of shares this universal cosmopolitan figure is that you have these sort of federal zones and that there's a common sort of operations within this, which is, as we've sort of seen, is a geography that has its own colonial lineage. It's a highly specific sort of framework by which it was, and it wasn't a kind of universal. I think the question in a certain way is in terms of the inventing of the universal, which is then would be the next question. Like, what is the universal that may be composed? And a synthetic universal as opposed to an a priori universal, maybe sort of where this becomes a little bit more interesting. At the same time, maybe that synthetic universal is one that is in fact predicated in some sort of way on forms of sort of actual universal. I don't know how to put this, but sort of an actual universal, right? That there's forms of a sort of a universal condition that are relatively fixed regardless, or relatively common regardless of the traditions by which they're constructed. The table of elements, the astronomical structures, the sort of bodies, right? That there is a sort of the actual sort of properties and conditions of physics and chemistry and mathematics are what they are, right? Through the construction of the sort of. So, at any rate, there's another sort of question of like how it is that synthetic universality, and by the common basis of the sort of terms of value, may be something that's constructed by a more another kind of Copernican turn, where Kant imagined himself as being in this group, but sort of another kind of Copernican towards a kind of the more actual universalities and what the conditions of a cosmopolitics that would be based upon that might be. I think is maybe the question that we may want to sort of work at this as well, which I think is a quite different. I hope it's clear that what I'm suggesting is, in a certain way, sort of the inverse of the kind of Latour and Stenger's notion that of the constructedness of the cosmopolitics is some sort of based on the multiplication of natures and so this. Again, I'm actually sort of arguing for the fixity of this. But anyway, I'll throw it back because it's obviously a huge, big thing. Yep. You had a
question. I just also thought of there was one other example that connects the present with the past, and it's also kind of based on the keyword of the human rights. And when the Paradise Papers came out, also like the super rich people on who had their money on the Isle of Man or registered with the Isle of Man, they said they claimed to have their rights on a private life, so they didn't want their names to be published, and they were kind of using this as an argument to be not exposed to the public. And also Quinn Slobodian, the historian we've been quoting in our presentation earlier, he is kind of tracing like how from as early as 1948 this kind of notion of or this kind of simultaneous that a human right is not necessarily protecting a human being but could also be a company or something else, so that this kind of the meaning of the word as such has gone rogue, one could say, or that like the tax havens might have become something like a simulacrum for humanity.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense, I would say that every single sphere has been better at leveraging the human rights conventions than the human rights sphere in many ways in terms of like effectiveness. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is certainly the case, I think, that the way that, for example, you know, World Bank or IMF has deployed kind of human rights in order to push for certain monetary policy within developing states, right, really kind of borrows a lot from the human rights rubric. And similarly, as you point out, the fact that right to privacy in and of itself can be leveraged in multiplicity of ways and not necessarily in the kind of within the aims of the liberal kind of the virtuous liberal ethical political project.
It's also so connected to property, no? The privacy thing
absolutely.
Is so connected to property.
Maybe important to quite important to remind ourselves of certain things. Sometimes I'm wary of using you know, this technical language that sort of emphasizes a phenomenon as if it were totally new. And actually, Benjamin was making it quite clear to us how Sesame, for instance, follows pretty much the same structure that was there in the 1948 Universal Declaration. On the one hand, the Declaration, if you read the preamble, the key word is standard. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These rights are presented not as moral or a priori precepts mm-hmm. to be applied to cases, mm-hmm. but as a standard. It's absolutely mm-hmm. explicit there. And the idea is that the standard would somehow carve up all the dimensions or facets of your behavior, and those will be compared to a certain gold standard.
Yeah.
On the one hand, that, you know, in that standard is that of the propertied individual, the white male with property, who has forward-looking vision, so he knows how to save, he knows how to speculate, he knows so he can govern himself, versus the so-called backward peoples who come, you know, behind and have to be helped or aided. And of course, that very same model, the worse for individuals, clearly comes from the colonial model, from the way in which the globe was carved up into two sorts of peoples.
Yeah, that's kind of
the intelligent ones, the forward-looking ones, and then the backwards, who will be the wretched of the earth. So there isn't much that is new in that architecture. What we are seeing now is a sort of acceleration of that architecture. Now the distinction in the near future will be between those who have the relative security of liquidity so as to bet against the rest of us mm-hmm. who don't have it. Mm-hmm. So we're the horses. We're the horse. let's make that absolutely clear. But the flip side of that, because this shouldn't be totally dystopian, is that it is you know, the way in which the universality of a politics can be falsified or verified is precisely to the re-entry of silenced voices or lost bodies, how those are made to count. Mm-hmm. It's very important to remember that before the Declaration, the Human Rights Declaration was drafted, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a piece called An Appeal to the World. He sent it to the drafters of the Declaration. To remind them that their universality had a huge blind spot from the very outset. In this case, the situation of African peoples in the diaspora. Similarly, and I made a reference to this, during the precedent to the Human Rights Declaration, you had these Frankfurt guys saying, you need to ask the question about the economic costs of war. And this is a question that we haven't asked just yet. We need to ask the question.
Well, I think...
Please go.
Well, I'm afraid we didn't incentivize time management as well as we should have, I guess, because we're actually running really out of time. And there is a wonderful event coming up for which both of you probably need to rest a little bit and and get prepared for. But does anyone have any last, like, burning quick comments that you need to... feel the quick being the operative word.
I just want to say that I don't think that there's a lot left of this universal language of human rights. If you look at Didier Fassin and his humanitarian reason, that increasingly we do not have rights to things, but we're sort of made indebted to get things. And on the other hand side, we have economics gaining new field and new ground with legal cases. I mean, everything that's fictional can be made into profit just by law and contract. And I think that's the direction that law is going. It's not, I mean, it's a totally different.
No, absolutely. System. I mean, I think that's the financial transition that we have sort of explored in detail or some detail within, you know, these set of presentations. But it seemed somehow important to come back to this 1948 moment, it particularly because it was, in a sense, it was almost anachronistic, right? It kind of emerged at a point.
I guess I just one last sort of point. I think we're thinking about sort of in a certain sense that this. In terms of the Declaration of Human Rights, on the sort of the point, that there's a structure that was put in place, and it had a certain kind, as you rightly say, a certain kind of platform logic rather than a legislative, retroletter sort of thing. And in a certain sense, it does kind of what platforms do, that it expanded beyond its original intention and became structured in this particular kind of way. So the fact that it gone on and there become this legal personification of multiplicities beyond the Lockean, Kantian, individual human kinds of structure, in a certain sort of way. I mean, on another sort of level, that may, in fact, we can also see this in a certain sense as a feature and not a bug, and that the kind of universality that we would want to compose, as opposed to sort of recognize as some kind of a priori, would probably be one in which that the individual human unit is not the base sort of structure of this as well. We'd have to go a bit lower in the stack, so to speak, to find the conditions of a universality that would actually. They would actually be more productive.
Yeah, we have to include too many other things, not just humans.
And not just humans.
Okay, well,
on this note,
I think we're going to have to wrap it up because we're getting some evil eyes. But please do refuel and come back for the chance session because I think it's going to be very wonderful and exciting. No, we're really super late. Yeah. They even were very kind and extended
Sorry.
Us. So, yes, but thank you so much.
Thank you so much to the audience for being here. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.